Isn't that, that is not unique to the Trump family, though, is it?
What is it?
Nepotism and lining one's own pockets off the public trough.
I am very much talking about kleptocracy as the dominant ideology of our time and holding them up as an example, but then I'm pivoting to something else, which you'll have to wait to see what it is.
Well, we got all that on tape, and I think that's a good sort of B-roll lead into.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Hey everybody, this is the second Access of Easy Salon. Charles is away doing other podcasts today, so it is Jesse and myself. We were thinking of getting guests on when it's only two of us, and we didn't have enough lead time for today. So joining me from a survivalist compound in the Ottawa Valley is Jesse Hirsch, and I am breaking quarantine in Western Toronto. I am Mark Jeftovic, and welcome to the Access of Easy Salon, episode two.
Technically, you're not breaking quarantine because you're still practicing physical distancing. Because correct me if I'm wrong, you are the only person in the office you're currently occupying.
I am the only person in the office here. Yes, I know.
Yeah. And as we established in episode one, you are an essential service as well.
Yes.
So I hate to say it, Mr. Rebel, but you're actually conforming to state policy.
I'm following the rules. Okay, so I'm rule following in Western Toronto, and and I'm not rocking the boat, and I'm doing what I'm told. How are you?
You're a very good citizen.
That's right.
I'm good. You know, I'm certainly thinking about the upgrades I need to do to my survivalist compound.
Right.
You know, the benefit of hardware stores being open is I've started doing the curbside pickup to start getting some of the building supplies and tools I need to, you know, add further upgrades to the compound and the property. Exciting times these are, if not rather slow.
You know what I do far too much and I feel bad about it is I order from Amazon all the time. You know, like hardware and stuff that I need to hunker down and emergency dried food rations. It all comes from Amazon, you know, and Amazon is becoming, well, I mean, their sales are up, their revenues are breaking records. I call them the company store now, you know, and I think by the time this is all over, that's what Amazon will be. And one of the items I have bookmarked for the forthcoming Access of Easy newsletter is a story on how Amazon, and this has been going on for years, how they use their data and their analytics across their platform to take the most successful products from third-party sellers, and then they create knockoffs, and then they put it out. And to me, that's when you look at Amazon knocking off their own successful resellers, and the process of Uber, let's say, taking over the personal transport industry and then moving towards driverless cars, it makes me think that we're reaching for an economy that's like Uruburus, the snake eating its own tail, until everything disappears up into its own, you know.
I very much agree with your general analysis, but I think where you may be a little optimistic is the idea that it's limited just to the economy, right?
Yes.
It's not Amazon. It's not Amazon as company store. It's Amazon as company town.
Yeah.
Right. In that the snow crash analogy is, you know, corporations replacing government in terms of providing those types of services, and that's where I would be a little concerned about depending upon Amazon, because their ability to profile you as a prepper, you know, that might make you an enemy of the Amazon state.
Yeah.
So where you've got this idea that, I'll still be able to buy my stuff from Amazon, it might be that you're one of the people Amazon chooses to round up.
Oh, believe me.
Because they anticipate that you might be one of those threats.
They don't have to round me up. They just have to put a nice little red screen up that says, you know, your account has been isolated as, you know, you can't order, you can't buy from the company store. And to your point, the company store can only exist in a company town. And Amazon is becoming one of the largest suppliers to the Pentagon and the US military. They lost that huge contract to Microsoft, and then they filed an injunction to have it overturned. It's like, you can't do that. And so they're having that reevaluated. I mean, I think they have probably a legal case for saying so, that the tender process was not valid. But anyhow, it's true. I mean, that's one of those pockets of cognitive dissonance for me, where I have this what's the word I'm looking for? That crisis in legitimacy for the nation state. I mean, we talk about that a lot, how it's really kind of obsoleting itself and becoming less and less relevant as time goes on. But are the alternatives kinder, friendlier, thousand points of light that are rising to take its place? And when I look at Amazon and Facebook and Google, I don't think so. They're even worse in some of the more malevolent aspects of what we fear from a nation state.
Well, and I think that's one of the primary reasons that the nation state remains viable, is because the alternatives are worse. You know, the tragedy is that there aren't better alternatives, because if there were, I think the nation state would have been dead long ago. If there was something for people who believe in freedom of speech, who believe in human rights, who, you know, believe in privacy, if there was an alternative for those people to rush to, not only would the business model of these corporations be threatened, but the nation state as well. And that's where I do want to push back a little on Uber, because where I agree with you that Amazon continues to be ascendant, that their power continues to grow and their control over the economy continues to expand, Uber is facing an existential crisis, as is Airbnb, in that a lot of these platforms, you know, really didn't have the kind of a structure, or from a Machiavellian perspective, the social control of an Amazon or a Facebook. And I think they're the ones who are vulnerable. And they're not vulnerable to the taxi industry. I think the taxi industry was very much displaced by Uber, but rather it's Google or Amazon or Facebook that will end up, you know, benefiting from Uber's disruption, and will end up being the people who are able to really respond to the shifting market reality. That I think Uber's kind of sunk, because their business model was never in check, versus for a larger tech titan to come in and steal their market share, I think that's quite plausible.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't put Uber out as one of these, you know, emerging victors of the snow crash scenario, as much as just typifying that dynamic of almost going a bridge too far in the logic. It's like, okay, here we're going to decentralize and make a multi-sided platform to disrupt this industry. And then once we've succeeded in doing that, we're going to eat ourselves. You know, we're going to just cannibalize out all the drivers, and we're going to put robo-taxis on the road, and then the whole thing is just run by a black box the size of an Apple TV. Right? But I was going to mention something else. What you were saying, you've heard the old adage that they used to say about democracy, right? Like, that it was the worst possible governance system except for all the others. And then that, it seems like that dynamic we may be headed into even more intensely. Have you ever read the Bruce Sterling book? I think it's called The Internet of Things, that came out. I might have to look it up, but it was a nonfiction book. It was like a long form essay where he talked about competition has taken the form of, never mind winner take all or first mover advantage, it's that their idea of disrupting your industry is that you shouldn't even exist, you know. Mm-hmm. So Uber's doing this, and to your point, Google could come along and just say, hey, you know what, we're just going to give away free car rides. Like, imagine Sidewalk, where just autonomous vehicular transport is just built into the fabric of Sidewalk Labs, you know, down by the harbor front, and Uber can't even function in that Google zone because it's just part of the infrastructure. And that, mm-hmm. I mean, it reminds me of the old cartoon of like the little fish and the bigger fish and the bigger fish. It just serial cannibalization that just goes ever upward. The counterbalance to this, I think if there's one ray of sunshine, which is a little tarnished these past couple of years, is actually Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and the whole decentralization wave. But, you know, I saw your eyes roll there. It's
well, I mean, I agree with the decentralization wave. I don't always agree with the cryptocurrency. I think cryptocurrency was a fantastic movement towards decentralization, but it's not there. It's just part of the process. And as long as we call it part of the process, I'm cool with it. But, you know, there's much work to be done. But I very much like how you brought up the, you know, democracy is the least shittiest system. In that, I think that that is a really important moral for us to remember, because the fallacy of authoritarianism is that it's efficient, right?
Yeah.
The big lie of dictatorships is that they work, because they don't.
No.
Right? If they did work, they'd still be here.
Yeah.
Right? The irony of such systems is they're grossly inefficient. They create chaos. They create confusion. They foster fear. And that's the opposite of what people want in response to this crisis. Right? And the extent to which I think democracy is the antidote, is the remedy, is something most people don't realize. And yet, on a gut level, I think they're feeling, because we're all pissed off about the authoritarianism that we're currently seeing. Whether it's the mandated lockdowns that could have and should have been consensual, or the, you know, I don't have the right phrase for it yet, you might better than me, but the suppressing of speech that's going on right now, and the extent to which unpopular opinions are literally being banished. You know, that's the worst way to handle them. That's the worst way to handle this crisis, when instead, this is when we should be reaffirming freedom of speech. This is when we should be affirming the ability of any idiot to express themselves and have an equal vote to anyone else, regardless of their intellect or education. You know, in losing sight of that, I think we're not only indulging in authoritarianism, but we're deluding ourselves to think that authoritarianism is going to do anything but make this situation way worse.
Yeah, and I'm not optimistic that we're going to come to our senses either. I think we're going to give authoritarianism a very good college try. And, you know, in historical contexts, that means the next 30 years, 50 years, mm-hmm. 75 years mm-hmm. could be really a police state, of which we're in the early innings right now.
I mean, I on an emotional level agree with you, but on an intellectual level, out of hope, I would say perhaps the internet accelerates things. So perhaps the internet, you know, causes these historical cycles to move faster than they would, you know, without the internet, without electronic media, without the amplification that these technologies enable. But at the same time, I do feel that this authoritarianism predates this crisis. Part of the reason that we are in such a ripe, fertile environment is because it has been among us. It's just not something we've taken seriously, and it's not something we've dealt with. And, you know, I recently encountered an article, and I want to pull it up so I get the language just right. Coronavirus didn't kill our privacy, it just exposed the corpse. And, you know, it's this idea that you know, we've been sleepwalking into this crisis, and it took this health pandemic to really shake us and make us see what was going on. And I think that's exactly why, on the one hand, authoritarianism has its greatest potential in, you know, 50 or more years. I also think, as a ray of hope, why we might be able to get out of it faster, in part because there has been a lot of a progress when it comes to the resistance, or decentralized alternative when it comes to resistance and stuff.
You know, that's an excellent point, because I have remarked elsewhere numerous times that it seemed to me and this is actually a line from a William Gibson novel, that when it came to things like Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, that entire zeitgeist, I'm going to call it, that movement, it moved at an accelerated pace. Gibson's line was like somebody permanently had their finger on the fast forward button. So even if you can just, if you want some numerical data to plot it against, just look at the Bitcoin price, okay? And yeah. And what we would call, in a stock market context, you would call, you know, a cyclical wave over years would take like months or 18 months in Bitcoin, and a secular, like Bitcoin is in like a secular wave of Bitcoin from the day it launched in 2009 to the day it peaked in 2018 was like a 10-year secular wave. And then there was a secular bear market. And I always said, you know, when something reasserts itself, leadership changes. So when there is really a resurgent upswing in cryptocurrency, in decentralization, blockchain, hash graph, whatever you want to call it, it's going to change its leadership probably. And but again, my point about all that was, is it's all compressed. It all happens very, very, you know, at just a much faster tempo.
Yeah.
And maybe to your point, that's right, because, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in again, because the unraveling that we tend to be seeing, that we're experiencing right now, it seems to be happening at a kind of a quickening pace.
Yeah. And that's been one of the documented cultural effects of the internet, that on the one hand it amplifies, but on the other hand it accelerates. And I think your point about Bitcoin's spot on, that Bitcoin, not just the speed by which cryptocurrencies became part of the public's imagination and impacted institutional, I mean, obviously there are still many institutions wrapping their heads around it, but there are IBM in particular who became champions of distributed ledger technology. And the extent to which that kind of, you know, Gartner hype curve of the, you know, height to denial to the trough of disillusionment to adoption, you know, Bitcoin was incredibly accelerated. And that's why I still think it's early days in terms of cryptocurrency, because for me, there has to be more public literacy and public understanding. And where Bitcoin is huge and fast, let's not underestimate the extent to which Bitcoin has fostered monetary literacy. Like before Bitcoin, the amount of people who knew what fiat currency was statistically zero, right? And now all of a sudden, you've got teenagers talking about fiat currency, right? Like that in and of itself is a knowledge revolution. But I'm still just saying early days, that, you know, the line I've always used was, it wasn't Napster, it was iTunes. You know, it wasn't AltaVista, it was Google. It wasn't Friendster, it was Facebook. It's not going to be Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's going to be something else.
Maybe it's Ethereum. Yeah, like, you know, maybe it's one of the shit coins that we ignore, and all of a sudden, because Dogecoins are funny and accessible to people, the kids of the world might decide to adopt it. But the point is, you know, we can't predict these things. But I think to bring it back full circle, while we are in an accelerated timeline, an accelerated culture, there are still limits to that speed. And I think the biggest limit is the human body. And insofar as the human body operates at a certain rhythm and operates at a certain speed, that's the governor in an engine sense that limits how fast we can go. But with that said, it's full steam ahead. And that's what I'm worried about in terms of authoritarianism, that before we have a chance to say, hey, this is stupid, people are going to embrace it. But on the flip side, hopefully then the opposition to it, armed with decentralized technology, will be just as quick in terms of demonstrating how inefficient and stupid the authoritarians are. And therefore, maybe we should give democracy, the best, shittiest system, another chance.
Have you ever heard the Chinese proverb, it takes 9 months to make a baby, no matter how many women are commissioned to the task?
That's awesome.
Yeah. They have some great sayings. So the worry that I have, though, is because of this clampdown on divergent thought, that what you're saying will happen as a reaction to it. You're probably right, there's going to be a reaction to it, but if you can't do it civilly, if you can't call a press conference, we're moving to those two doctors now, you knew we were headed there, right? If you can't call a press conference and not ram it down the public's throat, but just whoever shows up to the conference shows up, and you state your case and you put your argument on the table, even if it's not entirely correct, and the reporters who were there don't have to run with the story, and the 5 million people who view it on YouTube don't have to view it on YouTube, but it happened because it hit a nerve. But then what happened next? You know, they got, we're of course talking about Dan Erickson and Arti Mahadi. Is that how you pronounce his name? Those two guys in...
Go ahead. I mean, I don't think who they are is as relevant as it's happening to more than just them.
Yes.
Right? That we have a situation happening right now in which people who are expressing either dissenting perspectives or perspectives that are not backed up by peer-reviewed or peer-respected medical evidence are being erased, are being suppressed. And where you and I do not necessarily agree on the amount of attention that these people should get, I think where we do agree is that it's fucked up to silence them. And it's a mistake to be suppressing speech that is either unpopular or even inaccurate, because it only adds sex appeal, right? It's the Streisand effect. The more you start to quash those things, the more attention they're going to get anyway.
Exactly. I mean, that's where our disagreement could disappear into its own logic, because to your point, and I said that in my book, right, deplatforming doesn't work because of the Streisand effect. That video has gone even more viral since it was taken down off of YouTube. The other thing I was going to say about that, it's not just science that is not peer-reviewed that's being deplatformed. It's, we were talking a little bit before we rolled tape, maybe it was via Signal this morning, about the infamous Trump remarks about drinking bleach, which is not what he said to do. But because he mentioned UV as a possible treatment for coronavirus, a publicly traded company that actually has peer-reviewed methodologies and is working on a UV treatment via intubation, the ultraviolet light in the lungs, they're looking at it, they got deplatformed just because if it came out of Trump's mouth, it's got to be misinformation. And so they just found this other company that was already running down this track since last year, at least. They've been in business since 2015, and they got deplatformed just because it was guilt by association. And I just,
I mean, I do agree with you that there should not be deplatforming, there should not be suppression of speech. I have no sympathy for the guilt by association part, because the President of the United States does say a lot of nonsense, which doesn't mean that it's 100% nonsense. I will grant that he does sometimes say things which can be proven elsewhere, but that doesn't mean that anything he says should be taken seriously. And I do think a little bit of guilt by association is not bad, insofar as it just makes us scrutinize them even more. But I agree that the deplatforming and the suppression of speech is stupid and unnecessary.
I don't know if I'm totally following your point. I mean, what if Trump gets up tomorrow and says, Zoom, it's a cesspool of malware, you should be using Jitsi instead, and suddenly we're canceled off the internet because that's what we're using for our video? Like, that's, isn't,
but again, that... again, I'm not supporting the canceling part.
Yeah.
But if he said that, then I would love for 1,000 developers to say, we better audit Jitsi's code. because the President of the United States said that, we better go comb through this open source code. To which I would say, that's why it's open source, so that anyone can scrutinize it. And if they find a problem with Jitsi, then I can be like, okay, I'm glad you guys locked. Right? So the scrutiny is what I'm calling for,
but
not the cancel.
In this same particular instance, right? Orange Man bad, he said it. So suddenly, never mind that Jitsi gets a free code review, suddenly Jesse Hirsch and Mark Jeftovic are alt-right adjacent because they use a software suite that Orange Man bad said is good.
Yeah, I'm not even going to entertain that stupidity.
Because it is stupidity. But that would happen.
I acknowledge that it happens. But the point is, I don't care.
You know,
like, if that happens, the people who buy that bait are not people who I'd be interested in talking to anyway.
But it would be like, right? And the way you...
But hold on, let's bring it back to this story, right? Because you, I think, totally misinterpreted why I shared that story with you. And it was about, it was a New York Times article saying that while YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter are suppressing all sorts of alternative viewpoints, they are not suppressing those same viewpoints when expressed by the President of the United States.
But the subtext to that...
I was highlighting that because that's hypocrisy.
Well, yes.
They shouldn't be suppressing anyone. And if they're not suppressing the president for saying X, why should they suppress other people for saying X? That's what I was saying.
And you are right. You are correct. But the subtext to what the New York Times and those other outlets were saying isn't to your point. It's really saying that anything that comes out of Trump's mouth is by definition not permissible. So why should it be, why are they permitting it to be said at all? Just hang on. So it's,
no,
they, the
I,
word,
I disagree.
The words pro-Trump, when you find them in the New York Times or the Washington Post or Vox or HuffPo, it is stated as a baked-in pejorative slur. So in our Jitsi hypothetical craziness, sorry, if Trump came out and endorsed Jitsi, suddenly Access of Easy, who uses software, you know, pro-Trump software, right? So suddenly it's like, okay, we might as well be on Gab now. We might as well be operating off of 4chan.
So look, I kind of feel that you're wasting my and the audience's time with your paranoia, and here's why, right?
Jesse thinks I'm paranoid. I'm making a note of that.
Well, come on. We're both paranoid. We can acknowledge that. Right? If you want to discuss that in a moment, go on. But the word subtext stands for subjective in the sense that it's your interpretation. I don't have that interpretation. I don't think that every time they evoke the President of the United States, they're assuming he's nuts. I think they're being skeptical. And I think we should be skeptical of everything that any politician has ever. And I think that's healthy in a democratic society. I think what you're arguing their subtext is not at all the case. I don't feel there's any evidence for that. I think what they're talking about is the hypocrisy of the platforms. That if the president is allowed to say these things on the platforms, then other people should be allowed to say these things on the platforms. Or conversely, if other people can't say these things on the platforms, then neither should the president. And in that debate, I am clearly on that everyone should be able to say whatever they want. The issue is not what people are saying. The issue is the platforms. That it's the platforms that are the problem. It's their algorithms that are the problem. It's their amplification of stupidity that is the problem. But fundamentally, people should have the right to be able to post what they want as long as they're not inciting violence, aka hate speech. But if they want to talk about this virus and some conspiracy theory, that could be their right.
I think it's crazy that these platforms, what they're attempting to do is referee reality. Like, it's... Yeah. Are you insane? That's what they're trying to do. I always go back to the, is it Jack Conte, the CEO of Patreon, his explainer video on YouTube, how he talks about how he thinks he's taken all subjectivity out of their platform, deplatform equation.
Hi everyone, so I want to do something a little unusual and make a video outlining Patreon's reasoning for taking down a creator's page. So to recap, Patreon recently took down the pages of all the members of Defend Europe, including Lauren Southern's page, and we also took down the IGD News page as well. Some people are really upset about this, some people have even accused Patreon of making decisions based on political ideology, so I'd like to clear all that up right now. Content policy and the decision to remove a creator page has absolutely nothing to do with politics and ideology, and has everything to do with a concept called manifest observable behavior. The purpose of using manifest observable behavior is to remove personal values and beliefs when the team is reviewing content. It's a review method that's entirely based on observable facts. What has a camera seen? What has an audio device recorded? It doesn't matter what your intentions are, your motivations, who you are, your identity, your ideology. The trust and safety team only looks at manifest observable behavior.
Because he looks at manifest observable behavior, and as he's describing this, I'm like, you're describing a court of law. Is what you're describing. What has somebody said? What is a camera picked up? What's this? It's like you're describing a trial, and that's what your abuse desk is doing, is you're conducting trials every day, every case you look at, but you're pretending, you're telling yourselves that it's a machine language, algorithmically correct, objective take on what is real and what isn't real.
But to your point, they're automating authoritarianism.
Like, yeah.
They're not just regulating reality. They are governing a society. That if yes. You assume that their users, the participants on the platform, are constituents, members of a society, then they're governing that society. And in particular, their justice system is guilty until proven innocent.
Yes.
Right? That when you are charged with a crime, the assumption is that there's guilt, and the review or the appeal looks for evidence to refute the guilt rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, where I think it's even more egregious is that in their arrogance, in their obliviousness, because these are just nerds, these are not political philosophers, these are not ideologues. Right? These are just nerds who built the better built mousetrap, and now they're figuring out how to contain the mice that they've captured.
Oh, right? I think some of them are ideologues. But go on. I think some of them are ideologues.
I don't think they're ideologues in the sense of a politician and a state. I think that part of I think their primary ideology is narcissism. And that they believe in themselves, and that they believe that everyone else believes in themselves. So yes, I agree that there's ideology at play, but I don't think that they think that they're reinventing government in the digital era and doing so in the form of a dictatorship. I think most of them actually think that their shit doesn't stink and that they're making a better world, versus I think that they're the ones building the authoritarian society, because they're an automated form of justice that presumes guilt and does not offer any rights like freedom of speech or freedom of assembly or all the other things that we associate with a democratic society.
You know, I've told you my theory before, right? You know, the neocortex doesn't fully form until you're 25 years old. And I think that if you become a billionaire before your neocortex is fully formed, it blows out your ability to experience self-awareness. And so you just become a narcissistic philosopher king that thinks you know it all.
Although the only difference between them and the non-billionaires is instead of a narcissist philosopher king, they're a narcissist serf. But they're still a narcissist.
Or just
right?
A narcissist at the court of the big tech platforms. Yeah.
Because if you think about it, the extent to which young people are being raised in an attention economy in which their dopamine is being doled out by this algorithm, you know, that fosters behavior, that fosters narcissism. It encourages them to see the world through their own really selfish perspective. And they're the foot soldiers, they're the brown shirts for the social media dictatorship.
You know, it's
that point about cancel culture, the extent to which these are the people who are trying to use mob rule as a way to mete out justice on these platforms.
You know what's missing there? The word that flashed into my mind as you started saying that is history. And, you know, there's no history. These people, because they're constantly immersed in a never-ending sequence of dopamine hits about what's happening right now. What did PewDiePie just put out 2 seconds ago? They don't understand that. Do you realize that, you know, when newspapers came out, they were Twitter when they first came out, and then how the world changed when the radio came out, when television happened. How did it change when the Gutenberg press was invented?
But I mean, let's tie this back to the accelerated culture. I would say that they do know history. It's just the history of the last 3 weeks or the history of the last 3 months. And, you know, while there are many people of our vintage and older who have probably taken time to learn 20th century history or Renaissance history or maybe even medieval history, you know, your point about media history, very few people study media history, and very few people looked at the relationship between radio and the rise of authoritarianism, or, you know, the role of newspapers in partisan propaganda, and, you know, the way in which they were never neutral or unbiased. Very few people understand these things, right? Very few people study that aspect of history, and I think, you know, narcissists the least, but I think this is partly why we're so vulnerable, both to the platforms manipulating our media, but also, you know, the lack of knowledge of history, and hence the stupidity of having to repeat it.
It's that sense of history, and I use that line on my daughter all the time. Like, I constantly try to convince her to read history. It's that sense of history that is one of the few things these days that calms me down a bit. When I see something that rhymes with today from the past, I can just take a step back and go, oh, okay, you know, it passed then, this too shall pass now. I'm thinking about when, I don't mean to bring this back to Trump again, and it's not really Trump, but when Trump pulled the US out of the Paris Climate Accord, I remember this Krugman tweet. Paul Krugman tweeted, thanks, he may have very literally killed the world, killed the planet. I just love the phrase literally and killed the planet. And then I was reading The Rise and Fall of Great Nations. Was that the book? Anyway, but it mentioned something about Nixon said something during the 70s when he was taking America temporarily off the gold standard. And Kurt Vonnegut said, I almost said tweeted, but Kurt Vonnegut said he may be the first president to win a war and lose the planet. You know, and it was the same sentiment. And I love Kurt Vonnegut. I've read every single one of his books. But it was that same realization that it was like, you know, it seemed just as existential and of mind-boggling importance then as it does now. And it's the only thing that's, well, anyway, I kind of lost my train of thought, but.
But I think part of what you're raising is the problem of rhetoric, especially hyperbolic, melodramatic rhetoric. Because I would argue that the failings of the climate change movement was their or else was so severe that most people said, well, we're fucked anyway, so I'm going to go buy me a new truck, right? And that's the problem of using such language. And I say that on a personal level, because I 100% believe in climate change and 100% believe in us taking radical action for climate change. And I bought myself a Ford F-150 about 14 or 16 months ago because I needed a truck. So there is a certain paradox to, you know, presenting these, if we don't do X, we're fucked. Most people will go, well, I guess we're fucked, so we don't need to do X. And I think that's part of the danger around this pandemic and the way in which the language around this pandemic is being used, because no matter what, we're going to get through this. The question is at what cost, at how many lives, at the damage to the economy. But when we, you know, indulge in determinism, when we indulge in technological determinism, we rob ourselves of any agency, and we rob ourselves of democracy, which is there's always another way. Like, it never has to be this way. There's always another way to do things, and that's the point of democracy. A dictatorship says, only this way, my way, can be done. Versus democracy says, you know, hey, maybe there's someone we didn't invite to the table who has a better idea. Let's see who else wants to come to the table.
You know, that's one of my contentions with, you know, the radical decarbonization people, the people, the New Green Deal that say these computer models are incontrovertible truth and the only possible course forward is this. I look at economics, right? So they're trying to control the climate, which, whether they care to admit it or not, not only has the human component, but it does have the solar component and the other components. So my point is, hang on.
But hold on. Let me just quickly intervene, because I don't think they're trying to control the climate. I think they're trying to control society.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
What they're trying to do is govern society. They want to take over the government.
Yes.
Right? As a response to climate. Please continue.
Yes, but they're trying to make a real-world impact on the climate, which is controlled, which is influenced by things beyond humanity. Because my point is, economics, the economy, is by definition 100% human agency. All right. Other than you know, exogenous factors like, I suppose, meteors and coronavirus, maybe. Okay.
So that's why I would agree with 75%.
Okay.
80% maybe.
Let's just say economics is more human agency than possibly climate is. And we cannot control the economy, okay? We have a bunch of people in central banks and writing elegant models on the blackboard, and they say, okay, here's a Laffer curve, and that means this is going to happen. If we put interest rates here and we target inflation here, we're never going to have a recession in our lifetimes again.
But just to, you know, point out the straw man in your argument, I know of no environmentalist and no climate advocate who believes we can control the climate. What they want to control is the oil industry.
Right.
What they want to control is governments and other industrial sectors. They, under no circumstances, have the illusion that the climate can be controlled. Quite the opposite.
So... there was
and this
a point...
is why the oil industry should be concerned, because their environmental activists say, we want to take you over.
Right. I was going to make a different point, but I kind of want to pursue that line of inquiry. But I will just mention, because it circles back to our whole orthogonal thought will not be permitted. Did you hear what happened with Michael Moore's new movie?
I've been seeing some of the scuttlebutt around it, but do tell.
Well, he put out his new movie. It's called, I think, Planet of the Humans, and it's a scathing attack on the environmental movement because it says that, you know, renewables like solar and wind just aren't going to cut it, and that it's basically... I haven't seen the movie. I actually downloaded it because I'm kind of wondering if YouTube's going to deplatform Michael Moore, right? But... you know,
he's
and that
from Flint, Michigan, so it's no surprise, right? He's an auto worker's son,
yeah,
if there ever was one, so it makes sense that he would be, you know, a little more critical of hardcore environmental orthodoxy and ideology,
right? Yeah, so he's really, you know, he's really getting the full court press from everyone. They were calling for the movie to be taken down,
yeah.
I mean. I can't understand, I mean, well, I do understand it, but people just take that in stride. They just think,
I mean, I think that what we're talking about is a cadre of zealots, a cadre of people who don't believe in freedom of speech, who, you know, are filled with anxiety.
Let me stop you right there. Let me stop you right there. Don't believe in freedom of speech. But Jesse... it's for safety. What if your speech is going to be potentially harmful? Isn't it okay to shut you the hell up then?
I don't, again, I think you're being a straw person. You're making another straw person argument.
Really?
Right?
Okay.
Freedom of speech is not an abstract concept. It's a legal concept. And as a legal concept, you know, there have been a lot of tests around the definition and scope, and that's where I personally do support hate speech being criminalized. So if you express violence against someone, especially with regard to their gender or their race or their sexual orientation, I agree that that's beyond the pale.
But hate speech is legally defined. Well, here in Canada, at least, I know it's legally defined.
Yes, but that's
here.
My point. But that was my point. That, you know, I feel the law has spent decades trying to test what acceptable speech and what isn't. And I think most of the examples that we're talking about on the internet are not examples of that, right? That most of the stuff censored on the internet shouldn't be censored. It should be stuff that could be discredited, that could be ignored, that could be criticized, but should not be suppressed or silenced. And that's where, to go back to my straw person argument, you may notice that I never say the name of the current president of the United States.
Right.
Right? I refer to the office,
right,
but I never say the person's name, because that person does not deserve any more of my attention.
He shall not be named, okay?
Yeah, like, I don't want to reinforce their credibility. I don't want to reinforce their authority. You know, I refer to the office because the office will survive the individual, but I do not refer to the individual. And I do the same thing with the people that you're describing on the internet, right? The people who are so paranoid about dissenting views, and I feel that they reside across the political spectrum. There are left-wing people who do this, there are right-wing people who do this, there are centrists who do it. In the history of politics, people have always tried to silence their opponents. And I've never believed in that. I've never believed in the idea that you should silence your opponents, that you should suppress speech. I like debate, I like diversity of perspective. And so the people who do want to silence their opponents, I don't give them any attention. I don't give them any time. They can go fuck themselves. I'll talk about the larger
I have
larger
to bleep
issue.
That now. Thank you very much. Where are we in this thing? Okay.
You don't need to bleep these things. This is, it's not like I said tabernacle or anything of equivalent potency.
There's a little tick box when you put it into the podcast feed for iTunes that says, is this episode explicit? Or is it non-explicit? Yeah.
Okay.
And if we
apologies,
don't...
I will refrain. I will use fork
it's
and
okay.
shirt and other, you know, good place allegories.
But I got to push...
But
I gotta,
you get what I'm saying about
I
don't want to feed the beast. I don't want to give these insecure authoritarians any more fuel or attention.
But I'm not... I'm going to push back on what I said being a straw man argument, because that... I'm not being hyperbolic there. That is the justification. That is the actual stated reason when someone gets deplatformed is like, oh, that could be harmful. And people who are, so hang on, the people who were like in my face when I posted that YouTube video were saying, you can't yell, they actually used the you can't yell fire in a movie theater. And I'm like, that is a bad analogy because that only holds up when you're in a movie theater. Really?
I think we have to be clear that even though there are people who you're Facebook friends with who are making that argument, they are serfs and they don't actually have power.
Okay, I have
the
to go.
The people with power are the platform. And it's the platforms that we should be holding accountable. And the platforms have a range of stupid reasons for suppressing speech. And we should deal with those reasons specifically when they happen. But just because our mutual friend Jim Carroll says that you're yelling fire in a theater doesn't mean he's right.
It wasn't.
And it doesn't mean that we should agree with him.
It wasn't, you know? Jim. It wasn't Jim. Jim said it was bad science, and bad science should not be, you know. Now I have to bleep that too.
But even though he's saying bad science, he's not right.
Exactly.
And we shouldn't give them credibility by acknowledging their argument.
Okay, going back to Jack Conte, CEO of Patreon, right? In his stated policy, he talked about manifest observable behavior that could be harmful to others. Okay, so that's not a straw man. That is one of the philosopher kings running a big chunk of the platform.
I agree, and that's why I don't use Patreon. I don't encourage people to use Patreon, right? So that's a valid point. That's a case where it's not the individual, it is the platform, and it is the platform's policy, and I think that's a very good reason why Patreon's problematic, right? Because they do, to your point, have this philosopher king attitude that we have a monopoly on the truth and you do not, right? And that's a problem. I agree 100%. I'm just saying that we shouldn't legitimize those ideas by allowing the people who, allowing the foot soldiers, allowing the brown shirts to feel that they are in the right. Instead, we should continue doing what we feel we need to do, which is support a decentralized democracy where freedom of speech and freedom of assembly continue to be core pillars of the society.
What's your take on freedom of assembly now that we're all on lockdown orders?
Well, that's why I mentioned it, kind of tongue in cheek, right? In that I do believe in physical distancing. I do believe in taking measures to protect the vulnerable and to limit the spread of this virus. But I feel it has to be consensual. I feel that as soon as you try to mandate these measures without the public support, they're going to ignore them. They're going to do what they need to do. And, you live in Toronto, where as of today, High Park, the largest, public green space, has been fenced off. Like, not just the gateway. They fenced off the entire park.
Yeah.
Which is stupid.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's, there's medical evidence that suggests that the virus is not transmitted outdoors, that it really needs a confined space or close physical proximity. So as long as people are in the park and not getting too close to each other, it's not that big a deal. If they really wanted to regulate it, they could, limit who goes in and out so they can do a capacity like they do at grocery stores.
Yeah.
But to close the whole thing is not only stupid, it does violate that freedom of assembly. That there should be some way in which people are allowed to gather.
Freedom of movement, right? I mean, you've got people living in apartment buildings and condos who have no fresh air. I remember living in a condo. One of the things I remember what you told me about moving to the Ottawa Valley was that, sorry, my daughter just texting me something, is the quality of the air. And it brought back memories of when we were living in our condo way back in the day in downtown Toronto. I remember sometimes sitting in my living room thinking, I can't get a decent lungful of air. And even going outside isn't really going to help unless I get to a park someplace, to a green space someplace where I can just get some nice air happening, And to fence off High Park, I actually didn't know that till you just mentioned it, because I haven't driven by there in a while, but I see other parks that were... Hang on, I gotta tell her. Yeah, okay.
No, but it's criminal, right? The idea that, that limiting people's ability to maintain their health in a health crisis is absolutely absurd. And further, it delegitimizes all the other public health advice that they're giving us. Not to mention that it's been contradictory, that one day they say you don't need masks and the next day they say you do.
Yeah.
Right? And all of this undermines the legitimacy of public health officials and the legitimacy of the government.
I thought I forgot what I was going to mention when my daughter texted, but you reminded me. The Imperial College study that said, worst case scenario with no mitigation, we're looking at 2.5 million deaths in the U.S. and 500,000 in England, right? And people, and they say that's with no lockdown or anything like that. And I wonder, okay, if everybody went on about their business and we still had the Olympics and baseball games and hockey games, okay, maybe you're looking at 2.5 million fatalities. But would the worst case scenario unfold if the governments did not issue lockdown orders? Or would people, is the population smart enough on their own to say, to just naturally, which, I'm a believer in market forces, they would say, I'm going to cancel some flights, I'm not going to go to the hockey game, the NHL, the NBA. They still might be able to say, you know, we're going to cancel the season or we're going to do televised only. Like, would society on its own have modified its behavior to come back from that worst case scenario without the government telling them to?
Yes, but nowhere near as effective. Because what has unfortunately reinforced my cynicism in this whole process is just how fundamentally stupid many people are. And not just stupid, because maybe stupid's the wrong word. Deliberately uninformed. Like, you know, head in the sand uninformed. And I think that's where government has a role. I don't agree with the actions that governments have taken, but I also don't think that they should have done nothing. And I think that there could have been a nuanced middle path that, you know, I do think things like sports had to be canceled. I do think that, you know, travel had to be restricted. And further, we also have to acknowledge, you know, you and I are relatively privileged as entrepreneurs in that we don't have to answer to anybody, really. But there are a lot of people who can't say no to their boss. And if their boss said, you have to show up at the meat packing plant in spite of the disease having an outbreak at the meat packing plant, you know, that's a problem. So that's where I do think that there was a role for government in managing this crisis. I just don't think they did it. I don't think they did a good job. I don't think they did what they could have done to both, you know, manage the economy better while also managing the pandemic. And I think what we saw was a lack of pandemic preparedness. That's the issue. They were not at all prepared for this when they ought to have been. But at the same time, I do agree with your, you know, argument that if governments had done nothing, we still would not have got the worst case scenario. That the market would have responded to all of this information, and there would have been a lot of actions taken spontaneously by individuals and companies. For example, Costco just announced that as of Monday next week, everyone must wear a mask to enter a Costco store. And I think that's great. Like, I actually think that that's a great example of a company looking at the medical research, acknowledging that wearing a mask can have a tremendous mitigating factor on transmission. And it strikes me as ironic that Costco is making that policy before the government does, and that actually, to your point, example, market responding effectively. I just think that it should have been the market and the government working in concert with civil society organizations and individuals, but instead we panicked, and the panic created chaos, and here we are trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together.
The reason I started chuckling at the Costco story is a lot in the libertarian circles, which, you know, I'm known to frequent, there's a contingent of them completely freaked out over that. They just went ballistic. I'm never going
to Costco. Why? What was their logic?
I'm never going to Costco again. You can't compel me to wear a mask. And it just, like, I'm a card-carrying libertarian. Everybody knows that. One of my criticisms of libertarianism is when they get it wrong, they just come across as solipsist douchebags, right? It's like, oh, for Christ's sakes, then don't go to Costco, right?
Exactly.
Because that's
the market.
It's that's the market, right? If you don't like what the buyer's selling, then don't buy it, you know?
No, as a card-carrying Costco member, I thought it was fantastic. And I like Costco for the honesty of the company, right? In that they make their profits off their membership fees, not their products. Mm-hmm. They have absolutely no margin and no markup on anything they sell, right? And that, to me, is a kind of honesty where we're like, we make money because you pay us a membership. If you value the membership, we make money. If you don't, we don't. And second, of all the big box retailers, they were the first to really come up with a system that forces physical distancing and that limits the amount of people in the store. So to your point, that's a great example of the market responding, and I'll reward them with my money as a result.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, where, and then where you see that get kind of distorted out of usefulness was in the Michigan order. I don't mean to pick on Michigan again, because I think I did last week too. They passed the law to limit number, to enforce physical distancing within the store, which resulted in you could get into the store, but you couldn't buy whatever you wanted in there. So then suddenly you have to make this choice of, well, what's essential to you? And what's essential for everyone and what's non-essential for everyone? And that's that, again, now you get to a point where that's the calculation problem. Nobody can do that.
Well, and, you know, to bring our conversation sort of to a close, because, mm-hmm. you know, we are running out of time, I kind of feel that the main moral or the primary insight of authoritarianism versus democracy is rigidity versus responsiveness.
Yeah.
Because, you know, to me, the primary symptom, the primary metric that you're in an authoritarian society is when it's rigid and brittle and incapable of responding to what is common sense or what is, to, you know, plain sight evidence. And yet a democratic society is supposed to have the ability of responsiveness, of resilience, that when a policy doesn't work, you change it. Mm-hmm. When something's not, a system's not working, you adjust it, right? That's the reason people would support a democracy, because it promises the flexibility to respect your rights and respect your needs, versus an authoritarian system demands conformity, right? It's stupidity that everyone knows is stupid, but you all got to toe the line because the commissar demands it or the party apparatchik expects it.
That's the hyper-normalization.
Yes, exactly. And that's what worries me about where we're headed or where we are, is that we are seeing this kind of stupid rigidity, and we're forgetting the kind of responsiveness and the adaptability that democracy is supposed to foster. And that, to me, is the primary argument as to why we should be revisiting and renewing democracy, because it offers us the flexibility and responsiveness that we're going to need as we rebuild the economy and rebuild society.
I think that's a good place to tie it off for this week, Jesse.
Right on.
All right.
I enjoyed this. I mean, even though I do want to have guests, I like the occasional.
Let me just hit stop, and we'll talk for a few minutes on a kind of a wind down basis here.
Oh, well, although I was thinking.
Oh. I think it could be too late. Yeah, I just killed it. Sorry.